Welcome to Ring of Fire. I'm Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
And I'm Sam Cedar. Today on Ring of Fire, Senator Al Franken will be joining us to discuss his role in the United States Senate. Marcus Melitzis, founder of the Daily Kos, will be here to talk about the dysfunctional state of American politics and what progressives can do to help fix our broken Congress. Jared Bernstein, former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, will tell us how the Obama administration's economic policies have prevented our economy from taking another nosedive. We encourage all of our listeners to follow Ring of Fire on Facebook and Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. You can also email us your thoughts on this week's show at info@ringoffireradio.com. And you can help support progressive media by subscribing to our podcast. Just go to our blog at ringoffireradio.com to sign up. And now you can sponsor an hour of Ring of Fire. If you'd like the world to know that you support Ring of Fire, go to www.ringoffireradio.com to find out more. This hour of Ring of Fire is brought to you by the Goldwater Law Firm in Phoenix, Arizona. Find them online at bobgoldwater.com. So, Bobby, this has been a busy week for us at Ring of Fire. Last weekend, I was at Netroots Nation, where we had the opportunity to interview a lot of both politicians and bloggers who were gathering for the annual convention of all of the Netroots. And we're going to be playing some interviews today. But you also were traveling as well.
I was in the Netherlands, and I spent a lot of time on the West Coast in California. I was in Sandpoint, Idaho. I spent a lot of time in West Virginia. My son was on that six-day march there. I was at Bonnaroo, and I also did something at the Country Western Music Festival in Nashville. Ate a lot of barbecue. I went to Bonnaroo. I'm now a regular there, Sam. I go. I've been invited year after year, and I love that place. That is
Well, that's a great it's a great music festival, but I'm not quite as hip as you are, so I never get invited to those places.
Bonnaroo, for people who don't know it, I think there's like 100,000 people go there. It's like a Woodstock that they do every year, and I went this year. The movie The Last Mountain, which came out, which is the movie about mountaintop removal mining in West Virginia, was played there, and it was standing room only crowds, and we got a really, really supportive crowd, and several thousand people saw the film, and I'm very, very, very happy about the way that film is done. We just got a 5-star review from the San Francisco Examiner, and the reviewer said it's only the third time in history they've given that to a documentary. And then The Chronicle, we've just gotten pretty much solid, great reviews, and the movie is doing astoundingly well across the country. And we did, it was shown, it was premiered in West Virginia to an extraordinary crowd, standing room only, incredibly supportive crowd in West Virginia. You know, 2/3 of the people in the state of West Virginia oppose mountaintop removal mining. But there's not a single elected politician in the state who will speak out against it. And that is the illustration of how completely the industry has subverted democracy in the state of West Virginia. If you look at the state, Sam, at every level, it shows what the future of the United States could be and where we're headed. It's the template for turning this country into a colonial economy, to a banana republic, to a company town. And if you go to West Virginia, at every level of government, the citizens have no rights. You know, the people who talk about property rights, well, you don't have property rights if you're in the coal fields of West Virginia. If you live anywhere near one of these mines, and there's a big likelihood that boulders will be raining down on your property, big boulders the size of cars and houses, toxic dust that is raining down all day long, that poisons your children, poisons your wells, dries up your streams. You have no property rights. You have no capacity in that state because the judiciary has been so corrupted and the laws and the legislatures have been so corrupted to just serve the interests of this industry and not serve the interests of the people of the state.
Bobby, let's talk about this concept of property rights, because I saw the film. I thought it was amazing. And you made a point about talking about the which I know you've talked about many times, but I hadn't heard this particular aspect of it. The idea of the commons, the idea that this notion that there are aspects of nature that preexisted our country, that preexisted our society, that are that belong to everyone. And so often we hear, particularly now with this rise of libertarian, or this convenient rise, I should say, of libertarianism in the Republican Party, this idea of absolute property rights, which actually leads to people saying that it is wrong for the U.S. government to pass laws that say you can't discriminate against someone based on color or against on their sexual orientation or their religion. But this notion of property rights, because there is a problem when you say that, when people argue that Massey mining can go in and exercise their property rights after they buy up or they lease this federal land, but they're imposing on the property rights of everyone around them, like you said, both in the way that they pollute the water, they pollute the air, and they make actually other people's property unlivable. Tell me about where that concept of the commons came from.
First of all, there's two ancient legal concepts that underlie all environmental laws. And, you know, the environmental laws that we have today are ancient laws. They're the modern codification of laws and rights that have been with us since the beginning of constitutional government. There's two principal bodies of law. One is called nuisance law, and that protects the rights of a homeowner to be free of burdens on his property. For example, in our country up until 1876, if you live next to a factory and smoke from that factory got onto your private property, as little as one day a year, you had an absolute right to shut down that factory because pollution was a trespass and nobody had a right to interfere with your use and enjoyment of your property. Everybody has a right to use their property in a way they see fit, but you're not allowed to use it in a way that diminishes or injures the use and enjoyment of your neighbor's property. And that's, you know, laws, it doesn't just underlie SAM environmental laws, but all laws that affect property rights. Like, you're not allowed to open a bordello in most jurisdictions next to a church because it would interfere with the use and enjoyment of that, you know, of that property as a church, or to, next to an elementary school, or in some jurisdictions, you're not allowed to use your property to sell pornography or whatever. Those are property rights, and you can't do something, you can't use your property in a way that diverts water or poisons the water or floods your neighbor's property. So that's the law of nuisance, and it protects private property from a neighboring polluter. There's a second body of law that is called the public trust doctrine that protects public properties. In other words, those properties, the shared resource of a community, what we call the commons or the commonwealth, those properties, those assets that are not susceptible to private property ownership, but by their nature are the property of the entire community, the air, the water, the wildlife, the fisheries, the wandering animals, public lands, beaches, aquifers. This law was first codified in the Code of Justinian 2,000 years ago in ancient Rome. And the law in ancient Rome was that if you were humble or noble, if you were a citizen of Rome, whether you're rich or poor, black or white, European or Asian, as long as you were a citizen of Rome, you had an absolute right to cross a beach, throw in a net, take out your share of the fish. The emperor himself couldn't stop you. And the first sign of a tyranny always involves efforts by private entities within, powerful private entities within a society, to privatize the public trust resources, to steal them from the public. So, for example, when Roman law collapsed in 375 AD, right-wing Christians burned the Library of Alexandria, burned all the human knowledge of the classic era so that the only source of knowledge would be their book, the Bible. And that's the beginning of the Dark Ages. And you had Roman law collapse across Europe, and local lords, feudal kings, began reasserting control over the public trust resources. For example, in England, King John said the deer no longer belong to the public. They now belong to the nobility, and only we can hunt them and the other game animals. And they were once an important social safety net, a food source for the poor during hard times. Well, now they were all owned by the rich. And that's what caused him, that's what got him in trouble with Robin Hood. He also, at the same time, erected navigational barriers on the Thames and the other rivers of England, and he sold monopolies to the fisheries so that what was once free, now you had to pay for. And that those...
Bobby, feudal kings are forcing us to take a break, but we'll come back and wrap this up and continue on with this conversation in just a moment. Back on Ring of Fire, I'm Sam Cedar, here with Bobby Kennedy. Mike Papantonio is out this week. Right now, we're running through the biggest stories of the past week that the traditional media didn't cover in depth. So, Bobby, we had to take a break, but you were explaining the two laws that have existed through the ages in terms of property, and one of them being the private property nuisance laws. You can't do something that's going to impair the enjoyment or the use of other, or interfere with the enjoyment or use of other people's property in terms of private property, and the notion of public property, ancient laws that have been passed down through Rome in response to what happened prior to the Dark Ages in Europe. And so where are
those
we now?
That second group is called the public trust doctrine, and it protects the commons, the publicly owned lands. And what I was saying, that King John in England began privatizing the commons, and this always happens in tyrannies. And he privatized the fisheries and sold monopolies and privatized the rivers of England, and so you couldn't navigate on them without paying a toll to a rich person. This caused the public to rise up. You couldn't hunt the deer. And they confronted King John at the Battle of Runnymede, and they forced him to sign the Magna Carta, which was the beginning of constitutional democracy on this planet. And the Magna Carta was the birthplace of all of our civil rights, all the rights in the Bill of Rights, including habeas corpus and, you know, all of these other rights. But it also, in addition, had two chapters on protection of the commons, of the air, the water, the wildlife, the fisheries, the public lands, that they belong to the people, that a ruler could not interfere with their use and enjoyment. Those laws descended to the people of the states when we had the revolution in our country, and those rights, and the constitution of every state basically says the water and the air of the state belong to the people. Everybody has a right to use them. Nobody can use them in a way that will diminish or injure their use and enjoyment by others. So this is ancient law, and a lot of times I'll sit across the table from a polluter who says, oh, it's not fair for you to, you know, to impose these laws on us. You know, these were invented by a bunch of hippies after Earth Day, and, you know, we're having trouble complying with them. But in fact, these laws, the protection of the environment, have existed since the beginning of government. And in fact, in the 1600s, there was a Clean Air Act in England that made it illegal to burn coal in stoves in London, and it was a capital crime, and people were executed for it. So, you know, these laws have been around forever. You've never been able to use your property in a way that pollutes. Pollution has always been illegal. And after Earth Day 19, you know, a lot of these laws were eroded by corruption and by compliant legislatures at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And in Earth Day 1970, the largest demonstration in American history, 20 million Americans, 10% of our population, came out onto the street and said, we want those laws back. And it frightened the politicians, Republicans and Democrats, and Nixon created EPA. Signed, their 28 laws were passed over the next 10 years that protect our air, water, endangered species, food safety, etc., wetlands, aquifers, beaches. But all those laws weren't new laws. They were simply the recodification of ancient laws that had existed for thousands of years. And, you know, today, when you hear libertarians talk, you know, the followers of Rand Paul who say everything should be free market capitalism. Well, I agree. I really believe that the free market works when it is harnessed to a social purpose. There's no such thing as a, you know, the free market is a tool. You know, it's not, it's like a hammer. You don't worship a hammer. You use it to build something that's good for your children. And the same, the free market is the most powerful economic engine ever created or ever devised, but it has to be harnessed to a social purpose. Otherwise, it just creates inexorably oligarchy and plutocracy. And so you have to say, okay, what kind of society do we want? Let's make market rules to help us get there as efficiently and effectively as we can. But there's one place where the market does not work, and this is the big gap in libertarian philosophy. It does not work in the commons, because in the commons, the air, the water, if you can just use the commons to dump your waste, you're going to do that. Or if you can catch every fish in the ocean, it's your individual economic incentive to catch the last fish and to dump all of your garbage into the water, the air, the public, because then the public pays for your production rather than you pay, and there is no market. And so what you have to have, one of the primary roles of government is to regulate behavior in the commons to make sure that there is a sustainable yield. Otherwise, there is an economic rule which is called tragedy of the commons. And what it means is if you just let the marketplace run free on the commons, that it will inexorably destroy the commons. That and in the Boston Common, if everybody could put their cow on it, the Boston Common would be overgrazed within a year, and there would be none left for anybody. So you have to say, you have to regulate how many cows you can allow, how many cows each family gets there, and how many fish can you catch in the ocean. How is that done? And how much pollution you can put in the air? All of these things have to be regulated by government. And that is the biggest gap in libertarian philosophy. And it's the one thing that the Pauls, Rand, and his son don't seem to understand, is that, environmental laws are not meant to
restrict. Well, I got to say this, Bobby. They may not understand it, but certainly I think those big industries that are exercise their will and use the commons as their dumping ground, use the commons as a way to basically shift that cost to the rest of us, they understand it. I think they just don't like it. But we've got to take a break, and we'll be right back with more news from Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Seder. This hour of Ring of Fire is brought to you by the Goldwater Law Firm in Phoenix, Arizona. You can find them online at bobgoldwater.com. We thank you for your support, and if you want to sponsor an hour of our show, go to our website at ringoffireradio.com to sign up. It's your support that helps keep us on air. And now, let's get back to this week's buried stories. So, Bobby, we're talking about somewhat of Netroots Nation. We're going to be having some interviews from there. Was there earlier this last weekend. And, of course, you were in West Virginia protecting the Blair Mountain from the utter destruction. And I was struck when I was watching The Last Mountain, this documentary which you were part of, and about this mountaintop removal. The images are stunning. It's almost impossible to imagine, as you look at the views from above, just how much destruction they do. And you can really only see it in the faces of the people who live in that area and in the stories of how many people got brain tumors or how many people contracted cancer from all of these pollutants. It really is it's a stunning film, but it's a horrible problem.
Listen, Sam, you know this and I know this. You live in the Catskills. If you tried to fill 25 feet of a Catskill tributary, which drains into the Hudson, you would go to jail. If you 25 feet. If you try to blow up a mountain in the Catskills or the Berkshires or the Sierra, California, Utah, Colorado, people would put you in a place for the criminally insane. But in West Virginia, they've buried not just 25 feet, but 2,500 miles of rivers and streams. They've blown up 500 biggest mountains in the state. They flattened over the past 10 years an area of the Appalachians larger than the state of Delaware. It's all illegal. You can't do that in this country. And in fact, when I debated Don Blankenship last year on West Virginia television on 90 Minute Debate, who was the head of CEO of Massey Energy, which is the worst of these companies, I said to him, I confronted him with the idea, with the fact that his own record showed that they had violated, his company violated the Clean Water Act 67,000 times in 5 years, the previous 5 years, plus tens of thousands of violations of labor laws, mine safe and health laws, other environmental laws. And I said, is it possible for you to make a profit without violating the law? And he said, no. So he acknowledged that what that industry is, a criminal enterprise. Their business plan is to violate the law daily, thousands of times, but then to dismantle the government and get away with it, to hide what they're doing from the press, and to make sure that there are no instrumentalities for democracy. So, as I said before, they've taken away property rights. Private property rights don't exist in West Virginia. They've taken away the capacity to participate in zoning laws and planning laws, which every other American has. You can't zone out mountaintop removal mining if you live in a community or participate in decisions about the destiny of your community. This is, you know, the fundamental cornerstone of local democracy. Transparency, which is the hallmark of democracy, has disappeared in West Virginia. Everything's done in secret since it's illegal. The agency that's supposed to protect West Virginians from pollution has become a sock puppet for the industry that it's supposed to regulate. The West Virginia DEP is just an instrumentality of Massey Energy. And then the judiciary has been corrupted, and virtually every politician, elected politician in the state has been corrupted by the industry. So you've got a banana republic. You've got, you know, all the instrumentalities of government that are essentially serving the interests of this profit-making industry. And incidentally, Don Blankenship made more than all of his shareholders combined. He made $190 million, and his shareholders made less. So this is a way of grinding down mountains. His workers make 15 bucks an hour after 25 years of work because he broke the unions. So this is not something that's bringing an economic benefit to the state. It's not bringing prosperity, as they'd have you believe. It's bringing poverty, destruction, and, you know, permanent economic serfdom to the state. And the reason this is important, Sam, is this is a template for what's happening now across the country. And this, the biggest symbol of this change is, you know, the Citizens United case, with which you're familiar, where you know, you're going to have corporations taking over our democracy, and human beings, communities, workers become commodities. And that, you know, that West Virginia is the model for what happens when you do that, which is the absolute Armageddon. It's the triumph of the forces of ignorance and greed and the destruction of God's landscapes and human communities, all in the sacrifice of greed of a few individuals who become masters of these corporations.
You know, the more conversations I have with people who don't even identify themselves as liberals or progressives per se, the concept that the incredible concentration of wealth in this country has not only led to economic disparities, has not only led to things like underfunding of Social Security because not as many wages are garnered because they're over the cap, but it has fundamentally altered the political dynamic. That's when these people talk about the idea that we now have a plutocracy, because with this incredible concentration of wealth becomes an incredible concentration of political power. And so while Massey Coal does not set out to oppress people and to destroy our environment, they have the ability to do so in a way that they've never experienced in the past, because their incredible wealth buys them this incredible political power and prevents government from functioning in the way that it should, that is, protecting the rights of all its citizens and the public commons. And so Russ Feingold has created an organization, Progressives United, in response to that Citizens United case. And he was, in his speech to Netroots Nation, sharply critical of not just, obviously, the Republicans who took massive advantage of the Citizens United case decided by the 5-4 majority, the conservative majority on the, and the corporatist majority, more importantly than just simply conservative majority on the court, and which led to literally tens of hundreds of millions of dollars being spent by organizations like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce on behalf of corporations whose names we don't know. We don't know if they're from this country or not, because this is all secret, because corporate money is now being considered speech. But he was also sharply critical of attempts by Democrats through their Priorities USA, a sort of a super PAC, to raise this corporate money. And it is in many respects the influx of corporate money into the Democratic Party that has really allowed for the corporate takeover of our government. They, of course, don't set out. This is not about conspiracy. They don't set out to take over the government, but that is the de facto result you have when you have this much money in the hands of very few who simply act in their own best interests, which are to maximize profits at the expense of the rest of us, because they simply do not care.
Well, you know, I talked with John Kerry the other day, and I ran into him, and we were talking about Citizens United, and he said, look, you know, it takes now to run for Senate, it takes a minimum, most states, $25 million. And he said, there's very, very few people who have the capacity to raise that from large numbers of people and $100 or even $1,000 donations. And he said, you know, for me, I can do that because of his presidential runs and because he's got a very wealthy wife, Teresa Hines, who supports his efforts. He said, but I can see, I've watched over the past 6 months how this tsunami of corporate cash is altering the behavior, the conduct, the philosophy, and the personal integrity of my colleagues. And when he said colleagues, he was talking about his Democratic colleagues. This is twisting and distorting the political process in this country. And I, you know, I just came back from Blair Mountain, as you know, but in 1921, 15,000 miners revolted against this system of a company town, of, you know, corporate colonialism in their state. They were attacked by state troopers who were representing the mine companies, but also by Warren Harding, who was in the pocket of the coal mining industry, who sent the U.S. military, the Army Air Force, to drop bombs, including poison gas bombs, on the miners to make sure that they couldn't unionize. And this is where this system takes you. And this is where we're heading in our country today.
Well, we have to take a break, Bobby, but let's touch on this when we come back, because the idea that people are shocked or it's hard for them to believe that there's actually an agenda to bust unions and to impose this type of stuff on ordinary people, really just need to look to history to see just how bad it was and how bad it can get. We got to take a break. We'll be right back after this. Back on Ring of Fire, I'm Sam Cedar here with Bobby Kennedy. Right now, Bobby and I are running through the news of the week that you might not have heard from the mainstream media. So, Bobby, we were talking about the tremendous amount of corrupting influence that corporate money has had on our government and continues to have, and its implications to us both in terms of people's health, in terms of the environment. I mean, this is a setting aside the actual policies that the different parties pursue, but just simply the idea that this corporate money can buy off regulations and destroy regulations and buy judges. And
you know, if you look, there's been an extraordinary parade this week, Sam, of this past two weeks of Supreme Court decisions. And I've said on this program before, my partner, Carl Copeland, started his legal career as the law clerk to the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Warren Burger. Of course, it was Republican. And my law partner is a Democrat who, you know, is an environmentalist. He kayaks to work every day across the Hudson River and rides a bike. He doesn't even own a car, but he's very, very smart. He's like from another planet. And he he has done an analysis of every decision by Alito, Roberts, Scalia, and Thomas. And what he says persistently is there is no coherent conservative philosophy. It's wrong to call these people conservatives because they're not conservatives. They have nothing really to do with conservatism. What they are is corporatists. There's no consistency in their decision except for the corporations always win. And the last decision they did this week was throwing out the case against Walmart and basically making it impossible for most people to do class action suits anymore, which of course is just a huge payout to large corporations. But if you look at the decisions, the only coherency, the only rules is consistent rule with all of these guys is that the corporations always win. If it's an individual against a corporation, the corporation wins. If it's government against an individual, the government wins. If it's government against a corporation, the corporation wins. And what we have to understand in this country is that the domination of business by government is called communism. The domination of government by business is called fascism. And our job is to walk that narrow trail in between, which is free market capitalism, which we don't have in this country. We have corporate crony capitalism and democracy, and keep big business at bay with our left hand and big government at bay with our right hand. And, you know, you hear the Tea Party talking all the time about the danger of big government. And, you know, I agree with that. And, you know, big government is a huge threat to democracy when government can torture people, when they can look into your private life, when they can illegally eavesdrop on hundreds of thousands of Americans, when they can jail people without habeas corpus, when they, you know, when they can persuade us, as the right wing has done and Fox News has done, that the Bill of Rights is a luxury we can no longer afford. And the Bill of Rights is designed to protect us not against corporations, but against government. And the Tea Party has been one of the major advocates for the destruction of the Bill of Rights in order to protect American security, which, of course, makes, you know, these big security firms and Lockheed and Boeing and, you know, all the big military firms richer. But to get rid of the Bill of Rights, and then so you do that, you get rid of the Bill of Rights, and big government is, you know, a huge threat to us when that happens. That's unfortunately not what they're scared about. When they think of big government, they just think of one issue, taxes. Right. But the old style conservatives used to think of big government as a threat to the rights, the individual rights in this country. And that's really what we, you know, conservatives need to get back to.
I've contended for a long time that we have that conservatism lives only in academia now, like Latin. It exists, but it's a dead language. I mean, what we have now are a movement conservatives, people who are simply on another team and don't realize that they're actually playing for the benefit of large corporations who simply want to make government anemic in its ability to protect individuals and its citizens.
And to regulate their bad behavior, which is costly to them. You know, if they want to dump their waste into the Hudson River, yeah, it's going to cost them something not to do that. So they hate that. But, you know, it's a big benefit to the public and to our society and to our civic life. And they don't care about those things, and to the mountains and the streams, which they flatten. You know, and these
free marketers, I mean, this is the fundamental lie.
And I hate when they call it, they have nothing to do with free market.
Exactly. Because if there was a legitimate free market, they would price in the cost of not polluting our water. They would price in the cost of actually digging into these mountains. They won't do it. What they're doing is they're simply having us pay the cost through some other mechanism. So the notion of a free market is a fundamental lie, and it is a fiction that is imposed upon us.
Their notion of a free market, and they've set up all these phony think tanks who claim to be free market think tanks, the American Enterprise Institute, the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, but they hate free market capitalism. What they really want, their objective is to create the philosophical underpinnings of corporate profit taking at any cost. And, you know, I believe in corporations. I own a bunch of corporations. They encourage people to assemble wealth and then to risk it, and they create jobs, and that's very good for our country. But they should not be running our government because corporations don't want the same thing for Americans, Sam, as Americans want. Corporations don't want democracy. They don't want free markets. They want profits. And the best way for them to get profits is to use our campaign finance system, which under Citizens United is just a system of legalized bribery, to get their hooks into a public official and then to get that public official to dismantle the marketplace, to give them a competitive edge and monopoly control, then to allow them to privatize the commons, which is just free money. And what these Tea Party people are doing and what Fox News is doing is to fight for absolute corporate domination of American society. And from the beginning of our national history, our greatest, most visionary political leadership has warned Americans against the domination of government by corporations, whether it's Teddy Roosevelt, a Republican, who said that American democracy would never be destroyed by a foreign enemy, but that our beloved democratic institutions would be robbed from us by malefactors of great wealth. Abraham Lincoln, who said, I have the South in front of me at the height of the Civil War, and I have the corporations behind me, and for my country, I fear the corporations were more. And Dwight Eisenhower, who warned us all in his most famous speech ever, another Republican, against the domination of the military-industrial complex. They all understood it. And today you have a Tea Party who is championing domination of our government and our nation by unsheathed corporate power.
Well said, Bobby. Couldn't have said it better. And you're absolutely right. And, well, we've got more coming up. So it was great talking to you.
Thank you, Sam. See you next week.
Still to come on Ring of Fire, former chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, Jared Bernstein will be joining us to talk about the Obama administration's economic policies. That's coming up, so stay with us. Sam Seder and Bobby Kennedy, right here on Ring of Fire. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Seder here with Bobby Kennedy. Mike Papantonio is out this week. Conservatives want us to believe that the economic policies of the Obama administration have done nothing but harm to our economy. They also want us to believe that our national debt is going to crush our children and grandchildren, apparently forgetting that Republican mantra put forth by Dick Cheney that, quote, deficits don't matter. The truth is that the actions of the Obama administration have prevented our economy from entering a double-dip recession, and most economists will actually say that the administration should spend even more than they already have. Joining me now to discuss this is Jared Bernstein, the former economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden.
So returning back to Netroots Nation, I am sitting now with Jared Bernstein. He was, until very recently, the chief economist for the Office of the Vice President, working very closely with Vice President Joe Biden, and is now is blogging daily. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, multiple times per day, I'd say.
I want to first ask you just sort of in a broad sense about your experience,
sure.
Because it's rare. Well, first off, it's just simply rare these days to be talking to someone who was working in the administration or the government in general and is now not sitting on the board of Citigroup or of some other major corporation.
Did I mention I was on the board of Citigroup? Just kidding.
I don't want to.
I'm not on the board of Citigroup.
And, well, so just tell me, I'm curious as to what your experiences were and what it feels like to transition back out of.
It was a great experience. I know that as someone who's coming in economics from a more progressive perspective. I think some people view that my experience as having been a contentious one, and I was always, you know, fighting with the rest of the team. Couldn't be further from the truth. Any group of economists are going to have different ways to approach different problems, but the folks I work with were absolutely great. When I think back to my work with Austin and Larry and Christy, Jason and Gene, I mean, the Keynesian imperative, which was so important when the economy was in deep recession, was something that was universally shared, not just by the economics team, but by the president and vice president as well. And it was a great moment to, a great and somewhat terrifying moment to try to really pull this economy from a potential depression back from the cliff, which I thought we did effectively and efficiently. Should we have done more? Absolutely an argument we'll be having for a long time. Could we do more right now? Should we? Absolutely, yes.
I think you're perceived as one of the last, maybe it's slightly inartful to say, liberal voices or more progressive or more Keynesian voices to be at the White House and to leave the White House. And I don't know, this is looking from an outsider. But let's talk about that notion of, because there's been much written, particularly lately, about that dynamic, about the idea that there needs to be some type of Keynesian reaction to the crisis. And there certainly was one. But what people are discussing now was the idea that simultaneously there was some very real concern in the White House that down the road you may be affecting inflation in such a way that bondholders might get a little nervous.
Not really. There was not so much a concern about inflation in that regard, because I think we all viewed the economy as suffering from a classical demand contraction, which typically leaves inflation to be pretty low. And that happens to be very much the case, especially what we call the core inflation, if you take out the more volatile food and energy components. Where people worry about the bond market is much more in the debt and deficit side of the ledger, where there are always going to be concerns that if bond markets become spooked by the level of debt that the government is carrying, they're going to insist on a very high interest rate premium when they go into the market to buy treasury bills.
And so there was this concern that if we spend too much money, we increase the debt too much. If we spend too much money in the context of actually straight on stimulus, or as I should say, spending as opposed to tax expenditures, that was one of the arguments as to why you wouldn't provide too much. I think at one point Tim Geithner has been quoted saying that's too much sugar for the economy. Mm-hmm. Do you think that at one point that notion of balancing that concern about that long-term mm-hmm. problem with bonds overcame the argument for
maybe to some extent? You know, it's very dynamic. I don't think that the White House is by any stretch of the imagination. I'm sure what I'm about to say is true. The White House is not out of the job creation business. The White House just the other day was talking about some tax measures that look to me very much like something you would do in a mode of stimulating more growth in the economy.
Is this the moratorium on payroll tax
for
employers?
That's right. The president talked about a payroll tax a credit the other day. There's, I think you're going to hear talk about extending unemployment compensation, because the unemployment rate is still so high. People need that. And there's a big multiplier with that. Those folks, you can imagine, spend the money.
Right.
And that ripples through the economy in a positive way. So the White House is not out of that business. Your word balance is exactly the right word. Balance means a couple of things. It means that you don't spend, hand over fist without regard for bang for the buck, or making sure you're spending effectively and efficiently. And it means you don't lose sight of your unsustainable budget over the longer term. But balance also means that you don't act too soon. We have a fragile recovery. We have a recovery which is in my view, a pretty amazing thing given where we were. But it's a recovery that doesn't it's a recovery that looks like recession to most people in the middle and lower income brackets. So it's much too early to be going to any kind of fiscal contraction or austerity or spending cuts. But it's not by any means too early. It's just the right time to be plotting the path to that sustainable budget.
It's looking more likely that we're going to actually have some of those austerity measures, doesn't it? I mean,
well, we are going to have some of those measures, no question about it. And frankly, if you look at the budget deficit in the out years, no matter who's scoring it, whether it's the White House or the Congressional Budget Office, you really will see unsustainable a path where debt as a share of the economy just keeps growing. And that's, you know, what do they say? Unsustainable trends can't be sustained. My point is that, yes, there will be. But it's a matter of when they start. Bernanke himself, who is no wild-eyed right. Keynesian radical, said the other day, it's a fragile recovery. And if you start going austere too soon, you're gonna choke it off. Look at what's going on in the UK.
How do you reconcile the idea that our 10-year Treasury bonds, mm-hmm. The interest rate, I think it dipped under 3 the other day. Yeah. I'm in Netroots Nation, so I lose track of time. Yeah.
Not following the T-bills. That, here,
right.
Huh?
But we're looking at sort of some historic lows in terms of rates.
That doesn't surprise me.
But how do you reconcile that with the fear that the debt is going to be problematic and the deficit is going to be problematic down the road?
That's a great question, and I think I can help you answer it. First of all, you know the concept of Occam's razor, I think that's
yes.
how you pronounce it, which is sometimes the simplest explanation is the best one. We have an economy with very deep excess capacity. The labor market has 9% unemployment, but about 16% underemployment. That's over 20 million people who either can't find work or can't find enough work. If you look at payrolls, they're growing, but they're not growing as fast as they need to. Inflation, as we've mentioned, is pretty quiet. So industrial capacity is below its historical average. So there's a lot of capacity. And that means that two things in the bond market. One, it means people don't necessarily have to insist on an inflation premium because inflation erodes the value of your bond holdings. So they don't need to be have a premium for that when they're buying the bond. They don't need the interest rate to be higher in that regard. But also, when the economy is kind of in a weaker mode like this, interest rates tend to be low because the Federal Reserve has them at about zero. So there's all kinds of reasons associated with what any Keynesian economist would look at and see a weak demand. So that's one side of the answer. The other side, so why the fear? Why all that fear? Why don't people just say weak demand, ergo low interest rates, ergo, you know, nothing to be worried about? The fear is based on the fact that that could change pretty quickly. That if investors believe that their investments in U.S. Treasury bills, whether it's the 50% of Treasury bill buyers who are domestic or the 50% who are abroad, often in Asian countries, if they believe that those investments are not safe, they will insist on a higher interest rate premium. And that can turn quickly, but I am of the mindset that it's much more the former than the latter.
Well, Jared Bernstein, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That interview was taped at Netroots Nation's. Jared Bernstein served as the chief economic advisor to the Vice President, Joe Biden. You can find his blog online at jaredbernsteinblog.com. Just ahead on Ring of Fire, author Justin Krebs will be joining us to talk about how we can use our liberal values in ways that go far beyond voting and campaigning. That's coming up, so stay with us. Sam Cedar and Bobby Kennedy, right here on Ring of Fire. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar here with Bobby Kennedy. Mike Papantonio is out this week. A lot of progressives think that their duties stop at the polling booth. But the truth is that we can do a lot more. And Justin Krebs has created an entire network dedicated to helping people live liberally. We caught up with each other at the Netroots Nation 2011 convention in Minneapolis.
Justin, welcome.
Thank you, Sam.
What do you guys do? I mean, it's just a drinking club or what? What's the theory behind this?
It's just a drinking club.
No.
But the theory is that when liberals get together in a social setting without necessarily having an agenda, without necessarily having to pay dues or have guest speakers, they can learn from each other. They can reaffirm each other's values. They can make each other feel more comfortable in their liberal identity. They can get recruited into campaigns. And we just think there needs to be a social entry point into politics and a social and cultural level where our political identities really become part of our everyday lives.
You guys have been around now for 7 years?
8 years.
Eight years?
We started right after the Iraq War in 2003. Hopefully we'll be running after that war still ends, but it's going for now. We're at 250 chapters of Drinking Liberally, which are our happy hours, taking place in big towns, small towns, red states, blue states, in almost all 50 states. And then we also have Laughing Liberally comedy shows, Screening Liberally films, and other Liberally groups in the Living Liberally constellation.
And, of course, people can go to the drinkingliberally.org.
You can go to drinkingliberally.org, livingliberally.org. They're all connected. And on drinkingliberally.org, the first thing you'll see is a map, and you can find a chapter near you. And if there isn't one, it's free and easy to start.
You know, I have to say that I know the effectiveness of your organization firsthand, both from the perspective of what we did on Air America, mm-hmm. The first time that we did a live show on the Majority Report on the Air America, covering the Republican National Convention, was at an event set up by Drinking Liberally. And I have people who to this day come up to me and say, the first time I ever heard about you guys was when I saw you at the Republican National Convention at the Tank at the time in New York City. And so it's a very effective. I mean, tell me about the I want to hear a little bit more about the theory sure. when you started this.
Well, exactly what you just identified, that people might have known your voice, they knew your personality, but that chance to connect with you face-to-face really deepened their relationship. And that's what we think can happen across the spectrum, that when people who meet each other and have real relationships and real connections online, but when they come together face-to-face, it deepens it in a really exciting way. We started in 03 because we wanted our own friends to talk politics more. And so we started meeting in a bar in Hell's Kitchen. But what happened wasn't just that our friends and friends of friends came. It was that strangers showed up. Strangers who felt a little bit isolated because they were reading blogs or shouting at their computer screen, but coming together, having a drink, having a meal, made them realize they weren't alone. We started it in New York, but it really has taken on an exciting life in more conservative areas. And that's where you see the theory of how this works really come into play. In places like Spartanburg, South Carolina, Idaho Falls, Idaho, there's nothing else called liberal for miles and miles around. And in these places, people really come together and they know they're not alone. The one phrase that I heard was people get the courage to come out of the closet as a liberal.
And it not just sort of functions on a sort of like an emotional or therapeutic side, but these are people who form the bases right. of organizing during elections or around issues or and so on, correct?
Absolutely. There are candidates, insurgent candidates who run, who make their first stop coming to a Drinking Liberally. It's a way of creating buzz, attracting volunteers, recruiting the support they need. We actually have several Drinking Liberally hosts themselves who have started running for office. In Mid-Cities, Texas, in the town of Colleyville, our host Kathleen Thompson ran for city council. She didn't win this time, but she's going to run again. In Fayetteville, Arkansas, and Providence, Rhode Island, our chapter hosts actually won seats in the state house. They're state legislators
now.
So we now have Drinking Liberally hosts that we have to address the honorable, which is absurd.
That's funny. And I also know, not just from the perspective of the support that it gave to Air America and the way that it sort of connected people, but also even as an author, when I went on a book tour with my book years ago, we basically went from Drinking Liberally chapters around the country, and it gave the foundation of selling liberal books.
It's a great asset for other progressive partners, especially partners that are promoting something cultural, books, films. We get approached by producers and authors all the time who say, we're going to be in these 20 cities showing screenings of our new film. We don't know people in those 20 cities. Can you help us? And if we can help, we love to. Our chapters love doing it. And if we keep growing chapters the way we are, we can assure our partners in publishing and film that there will always be a progressive ally for them on the ground.
What are some of the The best ways to live as
best a liberal. Ways to live like a liberal. Well, one obviously is listening liberally. You should support progressive voices on radio and
Thank
podcasts.
You very much, yes.
You know, another way that I would say is you can think about how you spend your money and how you treat your money. There's a section in the book called Spending Liberally. It doesn't mean spending a lot, but it means spending wisely. The idea of the book, the 538 ways to live like a liberal, aren't the only ways, they're not all the ways, but it's to start a conversation that in your everyday life you can be making different choices, and you'll come up with ideas that I didn't even discuss in the book, and you'll also find things that I don't do. It's not like these are the 538
right.
things Justin Krebs does. You know, eat less meat would be a good way to eat like a liberal. And I can tell you, I was at that barbecue that the Alliance of American Manufacturers threw last night. I ate four kinds of meat, so you know, hopefully we're improving.
Well, Justin Krebs, the website is
livingliberally.org.
And the book is 538 Ways to Live Like a Liberal. Thank you so much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you, Sam.
Coming up on Ring of Fire, founder of the Daily Kos, Marcus Melitzis, will be here to tell us about this year's Netroots Nation and how he helped start the program 6 years ago in an attempt to bring progressives together. That's coming up, so stay with us. Sam Cedar and Bobby Kennedy right here on Ring of Fire. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. If you want to help keep progressive voices on the air, then we encourage you to sign up to sponsor an hour of our show. This hour of Ring of Fire is brought to you by the law firm of Whites & Luxembourg. Headquartered in New York City with branch offices in several states, Whites & Luxembourg represents thousands of Americans who are injured by asbestos products, defective medicines, and medical devices, as well as toxic environmental pollution and other forms of corporate negligence. You can visit them online at whiteslux.com. Last week was the 6th annual Netroots Nation Convention, where a few thousand progressives gathered to talk about politics, society, and the future of America. Since that first year, Netroots has grown into the largest gathering of progressives in America and has helped create large grassroots movement that has been on the forefront of the social media revolution in America and has used that network to spread the truth about what's happening in America. Joining me now from Netroots Nation is Marcos Melitzis, founder of the Daily Kos, who helped form Netroots Nation and has played a large part in making it such an influential movement.
Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome to the program, live from Netroots Nation, or I should say live from tape from Netroots Nation, is Marcos Melitzis. He is the founder, publisher of Daily Kos, the left's biggest sort of, I guess, non-corporatized blog that is out there.
And hopefully a longtime friend of Sam.
Well, yes. Marcos was one of the first people I ever interviewed as a radio host, probably even just before I became a real radio host.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome. And that was when I was actually a fraction of the influence and size. So I actually have a lot of affection and love for you and everything you've been doing, Sam, because you actually, I think, were part of the reason that Daily Kos has grown.
Well, I appreciate that, Marcos. And we're at Netroots Nation, which originally started as a yearly Kos. And I know this story many times over, but tell the story of how it started, and then let's get into what has changed, not just with the convention, but the blogosphere in general.
Yeah, it started back in 2005, I believe. I had a couple of people from the Daily Kos community, not the Daily Kos staff, because there really wasn't much beyond me, but the Daily Kos community saying that they wanted to get together and meet and meet in person. And I thought, well, great. So the first year, nothing really happened. But then by 2006, they'd gotten their act together, and a lady named Gina Cooper got a group of volunteers. None of them had any experience whatsoever in running conventions or events of any kind. I mean, these were people. Gina Cooper was a school teacher. I mean, these people are like nothing to do with convention running. And so Gina comes up to me. She says, okay, I think we're ready to pull a trigger. Can we use your name? And I was like, oh, man, okay. You guys are who? And you're a teacher. You want to put together a conference? Yeah, why the hell not? You know, let's go for it. And by let's, I mean you go for it, because
right.
I'm not going to do anything. I'm too busy as it is. And, you know, so it was Yearly Kos was born. And people keep giving credit to Daily Kos and giving credit to me for the conference, when, in fact, all I did was sort of create a sort of platform that allowed these people to come together and organize. So maybe indirectly, Daily Kos is you know, to blame for this conference, so I get credit. But really, it was a bunch of volunteers who did the work. And what was amazing is that first year in Las Vegas in 2006, I went to the hotel, and it was like the crappiest hotel in Las Vegas.
Yes, I think that hotel, I can't remember which one it was, but I'm fairly convinced that it was destroyed shortly after the convention.
It was a dump. And but I walked in, and I expected them to say, okay, the convention in quote marks, is down the hallway, past the water cooler, take a left at the vending machine, and that little room at the back, right?
Right.
That's the convention, right? And I would have been perfectly happy with that, to be honest. And then I walk in, and it's a real convention. And I looked around. I was like, okay, this is really, really weird. And my name's over everything, the coast name. And so it's kind of a little surreal. And the best part about that conference for me is at the end of it, a New York Times reporter came up to me, and he said, you know, I've been covering these liberal, progressive conferences for over 20 years. This is the first one I've ever been to where every session started on time. Now, that seems like such a trite thing, right? But to me, it sort of signified kind of a guiding ethos of the Netroots, which is the amateurs will often, if not always, do a better job than the so-called professionals.
Yeah, that first, that's a great point. That first yearly COS was, we had covered it from Air America. The majority, old Majority Report had gone down there to cover it. And there was this sort of, the first day and a half was just everyone just sort of almost astonished that this many people were there, that the crowd was the convention goers were not these pimply-faced 18-year-olds sitting in there, you know, coming out of the basement in their pajamas. They were lawyers and real estate brokers and a huge mix of people and ages that were all adult, and the whole thing worked. That was sort of the stunning.
It busted a lot of stereotypes, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I remember the first day, there was about 30 reporters there, and suddenly by day three of the conference, there was about 200 reporters there. So I think they all went back and called up their newsrooms and said, holy crap, you got to send more people because something's happening here. And something was happening there. And you know, it's funny because I remember my keynote address, right? That was back in the day when we couldn't get better speakers than me, right? So I was a keynote address. And I went up there and I said, you know, I just saw a poll today. And it's that Ned Lamont is beating Joe Lieberman in the Connecticut primary. He's losing by only 15 points, right? Everybody just went crazy. And I remember these political reports in there going, wait, Joe Lieberman's winning by 15 points. What are they cheering about? But we'd been down by 40
right.
In the previous poll, and so we had that momentum. And there was this energy of, like, being down by 15 points, that's nothing. We can get through that, right? We can beat that. And, of course, we did beat Joe Lieberman right. In that primary. So it's a time of opportunity. It was a time everything was brand new and exciting. And if you ask what's changed is that we sort of become more institutionalized as a movement. We're getting more professionalized, but not in a negative way, you know, because we're more sophisticated. People know what they're doing a lot more. The tools have become better. So it's all evolving. And so we're not as fresh and new of a story because we're not fresh and new anymore. But as far as our effectiveness, I think we're still in the upward trajectory.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about that because I think, you know, there's two elements. When you say the Netroots have become more professionalized, there's almost two sort of elements of that. One is, for instance, Daily Kos or Fire Dog Lake or Crooks and Liars, where these are blogs that have grown bigger. They have staffs now. You provide
18 right now.
I mean, that is a small company.
I don't know.
That's
how
not
I
even it's
payroll.
A mid-sized company. But you have a staff and you have. A division that sort of functions on political action and video. And then the other part of the professionalization are where the single bloggers are now parts of institutions and larger media outlets or this and that. And do you think that part of it, where some of those voices have sort of gotten sucked into the institutions of the liberal establishment or the non-establishment?
Yeah, no, it's happened. I don't think that's a bad thing. I mean, if we were complaining that the Washington Post didn't have enough progressive voices, but now we have Greg Sargent, you know, reporting out of the Washington Post, that's a good thing. Or Matt Iglesias and whoever's in, you know, I forget who's where because they switch like every 6 months,
yes,
right? It's like
true.
A revolving
yes.
door. So I lose track of who is where. But you know, the fact is, if the Netroots is sort of a farm team for good progressive voices and they end up in these more traditional media outlets that are looking to ride the wave, I don't see that as a bad thing. I see that as a good thing. I mean, clearly it's not the direction Daily Coast is going to go.
Right.
And my, you know, if nothing else, my writers have been loyal, and I don't think I've lost a single writer voluntarily. I mean, you know, we've had people die and that sort of thing, but voluntarily somebody leaving and saying, oh, I want it, that doesn't happen at Daily Coast, right? Because people are happy with the platform and they're happy with what Daily Coast offers. But if other people elsewhere want to move up to these traditional media outlets, fantastic. I mean, that's a good thing, not a bad thing. Because, I mean, what we've seen in the recent past was that it was the right wing that was providing the farm team for a lot of these for a lot of these traditional media outlets. So at least we can start to balance that out.
I think that's a good point. But I think what's so important about a blog like Daily Kos is that while I think there's a lot to be said about having people move up into these institutions and changing the sort of the perspective of the writers in those institutions, the one thing that I that is so crucial about a Daily Kos is that you don't have to worry about saying certain things that are going to get your organization in trouble. You don't have to worry about saying things that will affect your access.
We have complete and total freedom to be ourselves and to do what made us successful. I mean, we were successful because we were outsiders taking shots at the Beltway insiders, and none of that has changed. It's one of our guiding ethos. You know, we don't care about access. We don't care about being first and having the scoop. Because when these publications that are so obsessed with the scoop, the way you get the scoop is you pick up favors, right, from these insider, quote, insiders. We don't play that insider game. You know, we're on the outside. And if somebody else wants to get the, quote, scoop, all the power to them, because that scoop lasts 5 minutes on the internet.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more. And don't forget that you can show your support for Ring of Fire by going to our website at ringoffireradio.com and sponsoring an hour of our show. It is your support that keeps us on air. This hour of Ring of Fire is brought to you by the law firm of Weitz and Luxembourg. Headquartered in New York City with branch offices in several states, Weitz and Luxembourg represents thousands of Americans who are injured by asbestos products, defective medicines, and medical devices. You can visit them online at WeitzLux.com. We appreciate your support of Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar, and we'll be right back. Back on Ring of Fire, I'm Sam Cedar. And now back to my interview with Marcos Melitzis from Netroots Nation. He's the founder of Daily Kos, and he's talking to me about the dysfunctional state of American politics and what progressives can do to help fix our broken Congress.
All right, so let's turn to a minute about what's happening sort of from a political standpoint. I mean, and I want to talk about one example where, for a long time, because we've been talking for years and years about what's been happening with politics, you were one of the biggest supporters. I want to use this more as an example, but I'd like to hear your thoughts about this. I know that John Tester from Montana, for instance, I cannot think of a single individual who was supportive of John Tester outside of Montana more than you, as early as you. I mean, I think the first time you met him, he was literally stopping his tractor, walking off his tractor on his farm to talk to you, I think for writing, when you were writing Crashing the Gates.
Right. I spent time with him researching the book when he was running for Senate. I pushed him heavily into the primary when the establishment had rallied around some no-name lawyer type that, you know, with some money, which is what the DSCC, the Democrats, usually like.
And he was, I think it was a DLCer, and you were determined.
And John Tester was his farmer, right? You know, it was a state legislator, and wasn't the kind of person that the party gravitates toward. You know, huge champion, raised a ton of money, probably raised more money for him than anybody else I've ever raised money for. Via the community, not me personally, but via the community. And I remember sitting with Chuck Schumer, and I met with Chuck Schumer in D.C., and, you know, we're talking shop, we're talking races. I mean, the guy's an election junkie extraordinaire, and I kept saying Montana. He's like, no, Montana. I was like, yeah, Montana. It was very early in the cycle, right? And he's like, I'm like, trust me, Montana. And I was, Virginia was the other one with Jim Webb, right?
Right.
But Montana was even bigger. And especially since Virginia's close to D.C., so they're a little more aware of what's happening in Virginia. But Montana's like a whole different world from D.C. And so I pushed them within the party. I pushed them outside the party. I pushed them with the community. And ultimately, he won by, 10,000 votes.
Right.
So we're not talking, you know, I'm not going to say I elected him or anything like that. I don't ever like to overstate my importance. But I'm sure it helped quite a bit to get him over that hump, the money we raised and the attention we got him and the buzz we built. So then he comes in and word is he's going to vote against the DREAM Act. Now, the DREAM Act, it legalizes children of undocumented immigrants who either get a college degree or join serve their nation in uniform in the
right.
military.
Every single thing that someone would ever say that they would want immigrants to be and why they appreciate yeah. immigrants, that was the precondition
yeah.
to getting that citizenship.
And you've already spent tens of thousands of dollars educating them because they have a right to a public education, primary and secondary education, right? So why wouldn't you? This is like such a brain dead piece of legislation. I cannot believe there's a debate over this. He comes out, you know, and word is he's going to vote against it, right? So I send notice to his staff that this is not a smart decision. You know, the polling shows that it's not, this is not an unpopular piece of legislation by any stretch of the imagination. Americans generally are very supportive of kids making, you know, a good future for themselves,
right.
either serving in the military or going to college. And and I got back a bunch of BS about literally the response to that email when me talking about don't take a baseball bat to my brothers and sisters and cousins. I'm Latino. People don't know. The response was, well, you know, he's really supportive of labeling of organic food, you know, from farms. And I was like, well, that's fantastic. I'm happy for organic foods on farms. But what the hell does that have to do with kids who are being deported to countries where they don't even speak the language because they had a temerity to try to get an education? And so when he actually ended up voting for it, you know, my response, and I talked about it here, so it's already been reported, my response was just two words, was F you, but not with the F, I mean the whole word.
Right.
So never nominate me to be a diplomat or an ambassador.
No, I'm right. No. But the point here is that there was a time where the mantra for the Netroots was more and better Democrats.
Yeah.
And do you think that we have entered an era where we are looking at a different strategy than that? I mean, the idea that maybe the idea isn't necessarily more Democrats, that part of the formula doesn't necessarily pay off in the way that we presume.
Yeah, no, I'm less interested in the more part for a couple of reasons. One, we have a Senate that's broken. Nothing's going to pass the Senate anyway, right? And we saw the House where the Democrats were constantly undermined time and time again by the Blue Dogs. Now, I think as bad as 2010 was, and 2010 was not a good year, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, but the silver lining is that the Republicans did us a favor by eliminating the Blue Dogs as a viable and relevant force. I mean, half our losses were Blue Dogs. They were completely decimated. A couple more have announced that they're retiring, right? So their numbers are very, very small. And moving forward, you know, redistricting in California and in Illinois are going to give us opportunities to pick up actual real Democrats. And not to mention that what we've seen with the Paul Ryan budget has completely soured Americans on Republicans in general. The House isn't only in play, but even if we win it by 10 seats, if we have a 10-seat majority, it's going to be a stronger majority than when we had a 80-seat majority with the Blue Dogs making up 60 of those seats, just constantly undermining Pelosi. So the idea is, you know, we don't need these supermajorities anymore. There may be regions that for now are lost. You know, hopefully we can get them back over time. I'm not abandoning anyone. But the idea is, if we're going to have a majority, we need a majority that's actually good Democrats. Otherwise, what's the point? Because, sure, we can try to prevent.
You can get seniority on committees, but it doesn't matter if you can't really pass any legislation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because I guess it's a quality emphasis on quality as opposed to quantity at this point. And that's a change, isn't it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's circumstances have changed, right? And we have to be flexible, obviously, if nothing else. We saw what a Democratic majority that was dominated by corporatist Democrats looked like. And it wasn't pretty. So the idea is, you know, we're going to rebuild this majority. We're going to do it the right way. I mean, we may lose the Senate because the map just looks terrible for us.
Right.
It's not even two people up.
Three to one Democrats running.
And not to mention that all the Republicans that are up for re-election except for me, Scott Brown and Susan Collins in Maine. Scott Brown's in Massachusetts. Those are the only like two real blue
right.
state Republicans. So we don't have a lot of opportunities. But the Senate's where everything good goes to die anyway, right? So it's not like you need a 60-vote majority to get anything done in the Senate, so they're not going to get, Republicans are not going to get 60 votes. We're not going to get 60 votes. It's impossible. So it's going to remain dysfunctional. And so at least let's get the House where, you know, the majority actually can make things happen and pass legislation. And if nothing else, Democrats can use the House as a place where we brand to Americans what Democrats are all about. I mean, Republicans have done that, thankfully, because now they're like, this is what we're about. Right. And Americans are like, oh, wait, no, that's not what we wanted. wait, what? You want to do what? So, Democrats don't have that problem. You know, Democrat problems have been more of the, nothing happened. They haven't focused so much on the economy. The stimulus was too short, you know, it was too small, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Those are problems of timidity. And the problems we had, those was because the blue dogs kept watering things down. They thought they'd get brownie points from the voters if we take that stimulus that would actually do something and turn it into tax cuts that don't do anything. And the voters didn't care, right? They voted him out anyway.
Well, Marcos Melitzas, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations with all the success of Daily Kos. And at least, you know, you midwifed what we're attending, and it's really impressive. And
appreciate that.
Thanks
so much
for talking.
Coming up on Ring of Fire, radio host Shannon Moore will be joining me to talk about the proposed pebble mine in Alaska that is threatening to destroy vital habitats for Alaskan salmon. That's just ahead, so stay with us. Sam Seder and Bobby Kennedy right here on Ring of Fire. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Seder. If you want to help keep progressive voices on air, then we encourage you to sign up to sponsor an hour of our show. This hour of Ring of Fire is brought to you by the law firm of Cotchett, Pitre, and McCarthy, great friends of the show who are out there every day fighting for the rights of American consumers and pushing back against the corporate takeover of America. Thank you for your continued support of Ring of Fire. The state of Alaska faces more environmental threats than most other areas of the country, and it doesn't look like the environmental destruction will be letting up anytime soon. The most recent environment killing proposal involves the creation of a mine in an area that is vital to salmon and the people who depend on the salmon as their primary source of food. Joining me now to talk about this is Shannon Moore, host of the Moore Up North radio program in Alaska. We recorded this interview at Netroots Nation 2011 in Minnesota.
So from Netroots Nation 2011, I am happy to be able to sit down and talk to Shannon Moore. She, of course, is the premier liberal talker in the state of Alaska. In fact, she is the only liberal talker on the Fox News Talk Alaska, I guess, network out in Alaska. And, of course, you can get more information at shannonmoore.com. Shannon, you've done a tremendous amount of reporting on Sarah Palin. Much of what we know from Sarah Palin in Alaska has been via you over the years. I don't want to talk about Sarah Palin. I'm quite sick with her, and I hope that she's no longer relevant. But there is a really important issue that's happening up in Alaska called Pebble Mine. Mm-hmm. And I want you to tell me about that.
All right. Yeah, there are things more toxic than Sarah Palin in Alaska. I know it's terrifying to think about it that way. But, you know, Sarah Palin's not going to be here in 1,000 years. And if the Pebble Mine goes through, the cyanide will be there in perpetuity.
Okay, well, first off, where is Pebble Mine and what's happening to it?
Well, I should probably talk about the area first. Bristol Bay is a region of Alaska that is one of the richest, most bountiful fisheries in the world. 60 million fish come back every year. Over 50% of the nation's seafood comes out of one bay in Alaska.
The 50% of the United States seafood comes out of this one bay. That's right. Stunning.
And Bristol Bay sort of slides down into the Bering Sea, which people watch Deadliest Catch, you know, of all the crabbers. I started commercial fishing in Alaska in 1978. And so I grew up commercial fishing. There are so many commercial fishermen in that region, but there's also subsistence a lot of indigenous people to Alaska who have been fishing there for 10,000 years. It is a pure wild, we're not allowed to say organic because that word is like controlled by the government now. And they're not sure what those wild salmon eat when they are in the ocean.
And that's why they're not organic.
So that we're not allowed to use the word organic. But well, it is a completely wild protein source, right? And the largest wild protein source in the world. It's the largest salmon run in the world. And it's...
They are free of toxins to the extent that our ocean is free of toxins.
Exactly. Exactly. And so they make this remarkable journey, you know, 4 years, and they return every year. They have this little GPS system that they know exactly what stream to go back to. They will swim, you know, in an inch of water to get back to where they were spawned at. It's just kind of a remarkable thing when you, I mean, nobody thinks of salmon as being really, like, remarkable, but the GPS in there, like, Garmin wishes they had. It's really phenomenal. But that region is very seismic. It's, well, Alaska is in general. The Ring of Fire, curious, the Ring of Fire that we live on, is also where the earthquake in Japan just happened. In 1964, Alaska had a 9.2 earthquake, bigger than the one that just happened in Japan.
Wow.
Tsunamis over 100 feet tall. And we had this thing called earth liquefaction, soil liquefaction, where the ground was shaking so hard for so long, over 5 minutes, that it forgot that it was ground and basically went liquid. And it was terrifying. And it was waving like water would. At the headwaters of Bristol Bay, where they want it, it's a proposed mine site. It's so seismic there, but it's also the aquifer. We're in the land of 10,000 smokes there, which are these vents, over 10,000 vents, because it's so volcanic. So we don't know how all the water systems hook underground, but they want to put the largest open pit mine ever proposed in North America there. It's 10.7 billion tons. Not pounds, tons of waste. The tailings pond with cyanide and waste and copper would be 20 miles long. I mean, just the size of this, not to mention the location, has never been done.
No, wait. Now, what is it? First of all, what are they mining for, and who is behind this?
Well, first, who's behind it? Anglo-American, Northern Dynasty.
These are all major mining companies.
Well, Northern Dynasty's never put one in. They're sort of a speculator. It's a Canadian company. They've never done a mine before, but they're a speculator. They get the permits, and they work through the process, and then they sell it to a mining company like Anglo-American.
I see. Okay.
Anglo-American, of course, a British company, so we've got Canadians, we've got Brits in there. Rio Tinto has about a 6% right now share. They've been trying to sell out of it because they just are like, we're getting a lot of flack from our shareholders.
What is it that they're mining for?
And they're precious metals, gold, copper specific, huge copper deposit, but gold. Tiffany, the jewelry company, has said that they will not buy any gold out of this mine.
Wow.
And they're not alone. There's dozens of jewelry companies who have now signed on, said, we're not going to buy gold from you.
Now, are companies like Tiffany's and these other jewelry companies, have they made these determinations that they're not going to buy any type of gold from these mines as a function of what activists have been doing? Or are they?
Absolutely. Okay. And because Native Alaskan people, sport fishermen, commercial fishermen, subsistence fishermen, have traveled. We've gone to D.C., I've gone to San Francisco, we've gone in and spent time and said, look, this isn't just what we eat that you could ship in. You know, there's a certain amount of providing for your family that the way that your culture has for 10,000 years. This is not just what we eat. This isn't just what we do. This is who we are.
We're going to take a break, but we'll be back with more from Shannon Moore in just a moment. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar here with Bobby Kennedy. Mike Papantonio is out this week. Let's get back to my interview with Shannon Moore of Moore Up North in Alaska, talking about Pebble Mine and how this could be the next environmental disaster in Alaska. Now, we're talking about building this massive, massive mine We're talking about the crap that comes out of this mine, ranging from just, you know, a lot of silt, I imagine, to elements that may be problematic for fish and whatnot. We're talking about an area where if this seismic activity ends up striking again, you're pouring all of this stuff, and never mind what they used in the context of mining. What is the supposed benefit for Alaska here? I mean, are they renting out this bay? Is there some type of leasing that's going on? Or is it just simply there's some politicians who are sort of getting some benefit on their own?
Well, Alaska's been colonized, basically, by oil. 6 years ago, when people ask oftentimes, how did Sarah Palin get in? Oh, my God. And it's like 10% of our legislature were indicted for taking bribes from oil companies. It's very easy to buy a seat in Alaska. You can buy a Senate seat for $1 million. You could buy every single ad on every single radio station and television station and in the newspaper for like $1 million. So it's very easy to have a big influence there. The Democratic Party nationally has kind of written Alaska off. They're like, it's a red state. Alaska was protested to even become a state because it was too progressive. I know, you're like, no way. We have a privacy clause in our Constitution. We decriminalized abortion before Roe v. Wade. Women had the right to vote 30 years before American women. Native Americans had the right to vote Native Alaskans had before Native Americans. So, you know, it is a place that you can go in with a lot of money and have really easily bought influence. And when the people out there are protesting it and saying that they don't want this mine, they don't want to give away their way of life, we are asking the questions, what's the benefit? Alaska gets 0.7% in taxes on mining. Less than 1%.
So are the only ostensible benefits, I mean, are we talking about federal land here?
This is state land. The river system runs into federal waters. Because this is the headwaters of Bristol Bay. It runs right into Bristol Bay, the Nooshiak River.
So this isn't a situation where somebody's coming in. They're building this massive mine on private land. This is state land that is being sold
permitted.
Or leased.
It'll be permitted. Which is a lease.
Okay, leased to a company that is going to do this mining. And this entire industry in Alaska accounts for less than 1% of tax revenue.
Not less than 1% of tax revenue. Their revenue is taxed at less than 1%.
Their revenues, wow.
Yes. So of the mines collectively right now in Alaska, there's one particular mine, Red Gold Mine, or Red Dog Mine, that actually in one day of profit pays the taxes for every single mine in the state. And it goes back to the Klondike days, and we wanted people to come to Alaska and settle and be gold miners in the big rush. And so they were really trying to get people to come and stay. And now we have this large-scale mining, and no one has had the political fortitude to be able to say, okay, we're actually going to make this. This isn't a renewable resource. On fish, we're paying 20% tax.
Stunning.
So on a renewable resource that we would trade for a non-renewable resource is so foolish. And the fact that, I mean, the majority of people I talk to out of Alaska are like, why is this even a debate? And I feel like I live in Crazyville because it shouldn't be. You should never say, here's something that we've had for 10,000 years. Alaska's been able to manage their fisheries, you know, pretty well. We have this great market. I was one of the plaintiffs.
Why would you jeopardize?
Yeah, exactly.
The one asset that is paying, right, like, that it providing like, 50% of the nation's, I mean, that it's like literally saying, like, you know, I'm a concert pianist. I think what I'm going to go do is some rock climbing with no, I'm just with my hands.
Right.
Or
we've got this prodigy here, this child who is Mozart and Van Gogh and Einstein all wrapped up into one. And then we've got this babysitter over here who's been convicted of molesting children every time he's ever molested a child before. But we're going to let him babysit this prodigy because he realizes this one's special and will take care of it.
Right.
Like, and they've never been able to do what they are proposing to do and do it without killing the fish. So it is really ludicrous. And you know, I look at this, and I was one of the plaintiffs during the Exxon Valdez spill. I heard them say, we will make you whole. My livelihood was destroyed. The suicide rates that happened not in the first year or the second year, but at 4 years and 6 years, if the same equivalent of people kill themselves in the Gulf over despair of how they're treated by a corporation, if BP pulls the same thing Exxon does, you're looking at 45,000 people killing
wow.
themselves. It was rampant despair, rampant frustration, and nothing we can do about it sort of feeling. So Alaska's already been through this process. It took us 20 years to get the Supreme Court to say, we'll give you 10 cents on the dollar. We've seen really relatively nothing new for safety. And, you know, having been up close and seen the Corexit and all the cleanup in Alaska, to watch the BP disaster unfold, there has been really very little advance in cleanup.
Right.
There has been a huge advance in exploration. I mean, now we've got fracking and we've got all these other things, but not in the cleanup. And when, at the time in 1989, I had one of the, remember the Macs? The Mac computers? I had
yes.
like the Mac Plus SE, like the badass computer, because my parents were teachers and Apple had a good deal for teachers. And it was, you know, this huge box with this little tiny screen. You remember? And it's
yes,
like you put the
course.
Disks in it. And okay. So 20 years later, I think about that computer and then look at an iPhone or an iPad, right? The technology between that and now, just in that area. And then I look at the pictures that I took from the Exxon disaster and I look at BP. It's the same exact technology. It's the same ridiculous booms, the same horrible chemicals. And I'm like, this isn't a priority. And now the cost of doing business has been established through the Exxon v. Baker case. So Pebble's not going to be any different. When they're, you know, I've done town halls all over Alaska, had people from, and they always come, people from the mining company always come to see what we're talking about or what I'm saying. And I actually asked one of the heads from Anglo American, I was like, so can you tell me there'll be zero effect on the fish? And he said, no. And I said, then you can't have your mine.
Okay, so this is obviously an issue that transcends Alaska, frankly. I mean, if any of us want to eat seafood again in this country going forward, the potential for destroying this resource that is an important national resource, where can people get more information and what can they do?
They can go to savebristolbay.org.
Savebristolbay.org. Okay.
And what we'd really like people to do is that right now, because this water, well, it's on state land, but the water flows into federal oceans.
Right.
It's under the EPA Clean Water Protection. So there's a section of that, 404C of the Clean Water Act, that we could, that Lisa Jackson, the Obama administration, could step in and say, you know what, we're not going to risk the nation's food security. And this is a food security issue. It absolutely
among
is.
Others, but
among
yes.
others. But nationally speaking, how it affects a lot of people is, other than we're going to have to pay for a Superfund site that's beyond anything that we've ever looked at before in this nation's history. There really is a chance that we can stop it through that. So I hope people will go check out SaveBristolBay.org. And
SaveBristolBay.org. You can support those organizations that are fighting this in state in Alaska, and also support this fight by pressuring our federal government through the EPA to make a determination that under the Clean Water Act, this is too risky a proposition,
right.
could cause just far too much damage to clean water and what we depend upon clean water for.
Well, that's why we have the act. I mean, that's why there is the Clean Water Act, to make sure that they're able to protect the nation's interest. And this is of national interest.
Shannon Moore, thank you so much for talking to us. ShannonMoore.com, always a pleasure. Great to see you here at NetRoots
Nation.
Thanks
to see you, too. All right.
Shannon Moore is the host of Moore Up North in Alaska, and you can find her online at ShannonMoore.com. Coming up on Ring of Fire, I caught up with Senator Al Franken from Netroots Nation 2011 in Minneapolis. He'll be talking to us about his work as U.S. Senator and what it was like to make the jump from radio to legislator. That's just ahead, so stay with us. Sam Cedar and Bobby Kennedy right here on Ring of Fire. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar here with Bobby Kennedy. Mike Papantonio is out this week. I am pleased to welcome Senator Al Franken back to Ring of Fire. I caught up with him at Netroots Nation in Minneapolis this year. The last time he appeared on the show, he was still a candidate for Senate. And after a bitter fight with his opponent and voter recounts, he was finally proclaimed the winner and became the junior senator from Minnesota. Here's that interview now.
So, Senator Franken, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
And this is actually your second Netroots Nation visit, yes? You were.
Yeah. Oh, it's Netroots?
You weren't aware of what it was?
No, I thought it was in the Truths. I've been pronouncing it wrong this whole time. I thought it was in the Truths, no?
No one wanted to correct you.
Well, I understand why. I'm a senator.
Yes, yeah. People, wear the pin now.
Yeah,
and so people
I do.
But, yeah, it's your second time here. And I want to talk, it's a real pleasure for me, obviously, to talk to you on the radio as a senator. I've spoken to you on the radio as a non-senator.
Well, as peers.
Yes, and... we have both moved in sort of completely opposite directions. I wouldn't. I mean, it's not a big deal.
You've moved. I think you've moved in a
lateral.
Lateral. I wouldn't say I've moved. I wouldn't say mine isn't lateral as well. It's just lateral to a whole different field.
Well, actually, let's talk about it because I want to talk about what you spoke about in your speech today. Because
sure.
I think this is sort of the pressing. Issue facing our country right now. But before we get to that, I want to talk about the because I think our listeners would be very curious to get a sense of what it feels like to move from the perspective that you had as someone who I perceive and always felt that you were one of the most informed people in politics. About politics, not in politics.
Sure.
And now you're in politics. You've gone from sort of outside looking in to inside looking out. Explain to me, what that feels like.
It's different, I got to tell you. I mean, it's a different job. And in many ways, it's harder. I think one thing about being a radio host is that... And the work you do on TV, too, and work... I was doing TV, is that you kind of get to pick what you talk about all the time. I mean, within a certain range of issues. That's not quite the same as a senator. A senator, you're dealing with everything all at the same time. I mean, you have committee assignments, and you do have little areas you can stake out. I mean, and that you can pick and be the expert on, or be the guy who does that, or the person who works on that. But you also are not, you really are, have responsibilities as one of only 100 to be dealing with sort of everything. And it's also, I came from comedy, and I used a lot of humor in my radio show. And I just can't do that as much in, humor is useful in the Senate. In terms of being funny around colleagues,
right?
But it's not like I can't go on the floor and be funny. I mean, I just can't.
Right.
Hearing something spontaneous comes up, it's fine. And also there are a number of arrows in my comedy quiver, and that I cannot use.
Right. You got to be careful as to which one you pull out.
I can't use the. Inappropriate arrow, which is a very
and I noticed
arrow.
You actually took some time in trying to figure out how to describe that inappropriate.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, it's an arrow that's very commonly used in comedy. It just is. I mean, and also especially with comedy writers in rooms with other comedy writers. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I understand.
And so that's off. But even you can't even use just plain old scorn and ridicule.
Right.
That's not good. You can use
self-deprecating. Imagine, you were talking yesterday a little bit about that you have on many occasions or reached across the aisle to work with some Republicans on stuff that's not terribly controversial.
No.
At least so that you can find
dogs for vets with emotional and mental wounds.
And I would imagine that building those relationships, I mean, I think people would be surprised, and tell me if I'm wrong, just how much personal relationships matter in the
Senate. They actually do. And it opens you up to, you know, my wife, Franny, has very good relationships with a lot of spouses of the Republican spouses. And so we've had, you know, we'll have like NZ from Wyoming and Johans over for dinner. And then I'll be able, you know, and then it'll change the kind of conversation I can have with Mike Enzi, who's the ranking member of the HELP committee on No Child Left Behind reauthorization. It just makes a difference. It just helps.
And
that's, you know, that has a sort of different, it's not the same terrible kind of problems that we're having on budget stuff.
Right.
And that kind of thing. It's a different, it has more substantive stuff that isn't quite so partisan, although there are certain divides now among Republican and Democrats on what the role of the federal government is versus the states in No Child Left Behind.
Is the Senate more dysfunctional now than it was even last year? I mean, at the beginning of this...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, last year it was dysfunctional, but we had 59. And when we had 59... it was easier to get things done than when you have 53. And now you just can't get anything. It's really hard. We have not had a jobs bill. And with the House the way it is, for example, we passed an FAA bill, and we did a pretty bipartisan basis. But we can't get the conferees from the House to be assigned.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy.
They won't even show up to reconcile.
Well, they haven't chosen their conferees, you know. So that's a jobs bill, by the way, the FAA bill. And so in 2010, I seem to recall they were talking about jobs a lot. I haven't seen a jobs bill come out of the House. And I've seen in the Senate them pretty much bottling up every jobs bill that we have.
Do you think that there's some... regret on behalf of Democrats who had, there was a window where people were talking about reforming the rules of the Senate, you know, early on.
Yeah,
in this,
well, there, it was,
do you think there's some regret that the opportunity wasn't taken?
You know, you have to do it with 50 or 51. We weren't even sure where Biden would be on that, because remember, he'd been in the institution for a long time, and there was a real divide between those who'd been in for a really long time and
who didn't want to change the filibuster rules at all or anything.
Well, yes, exactly. We wanted to change the filibuster rules. No one wanted to get rid of the filibuster, although Harkin actually wanted to get it down to where over a period of time it would get down to 51 that you needed, which is really, in a way, getting rid of the filibuster. But most of us felt like, no, keep it at 60, but you have to hold the floor of the Senate. You have
right.
to pay a price to do a filibuster. You have to actually filibuster. It has to look a little like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Right, right.
You know, you have to do it. It doesn't have to be one. If only one person is filibustering, then one person can hold it as long until they collapse like Jimmy Stewart did. But if...
And that would be a great YouTube, I would add.
I was thinking of doing one where I mean, this is like what I can't do. You know, I was thinking of doing one where I pretend I'm filibustering, but I collapse like in about 45 seconds. I just thought that'd be funny, but I don't do that.
So, do you think there's any sense? That, I mean, do people regret that though? I mean, do you think there are senators?
I mean, are there senators who
regret that they didn't take that opportunity?
No, because I think the ones that stopped us from doing it still believe that they did the right thing.
And
I don't know why exactly. And there are some people I respect, but they're really the old war horses. I heard a lot of guys say, you know, wait till you're in the minority.
Right, in terms
yeah,
of what...
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, I hope that in the event that that does happen, which I hope it doesn't happen, but in the event that it does, that people exercise the...
restraint on the other side?
An equal amount of restraint, or
yeah.
I should say lack of restraint.
Well, I mean that on the Republicans don't immediately go boom. Okay, we got 51. Let's change all the rules. That's what you're hoping they don't do, right?
Well, I mean, I'm hoping they don't change those rules, I guess. But I think it's also I'm hoping that if they don't change those rules, that they that the Democrats will exercise the same
lack of restraint in stopping them. We aren't as disciplined as them, but there'll be enough of us to stop egregious stuff. Let's not even talk like this, though. We're going to win.
Right.
We're going to keep the majority.
I
forever and ever.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more from Senator Al Franken when we return. And don't forget that you can help support Ring of Fire by sponsoring an hour of our show. Just go to our blog at ringoffireradio.com to sign up. I'm Sam Cedar here with Bobby Kennedy, and we'll be right back with more Ring of Fire. We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Sam Cedar. Let's get back to our interview with Senator Al Franken, which we taped at Netroots Nation in Minneapolis this year, about his new role as United States Senator.
You spoke, you basically said that progressives, I'm going to quote you, in fact.
Okay.
Progressives are losing, we progressives are losing the argument, that you acknowledge that there are reasons for us to be frustrated with what Democrats are doing in Washington, what the president might be doing, but that we're losing the broader argument. What I was basically saying is
we all know there's global warming. how are we losing that argument? You know, we want to do cap and trade, and that's what we should be maybe arguing over. Now I had a thing the other day in the there are these forest fires out west, right? And they're much worse because of climate change.
Right.
And I asked the director of, the chief of the Forest Service about it, and he said, yeah, our scientists say that it's much worse because of climate change. Then I had a Republican colleague of mine say, I have a degree in forestry, forest management, which I'm sure Senator Franken doesn't have. And then he started, he didn't ask a question, he just did a speech on
trees.
On how environmentalists have caused this because they don't
cull the forest.
Cut the forest, which there is an actual little point there that there is a thing called sustainable forests, and we do have to do some cleaning out of that stuff. But then, thank God we had a second round. And I said, I come at this with a great deal of humility. I don't have a degree in forest management, but let me ask you, Chief, the scientists in your Department of Forestry, do they have degrees?
Yes.
And what would those be in? And so I made my point. The fact is that we're having that argument.
Well, yeah,
means we're losing the argument because it's just crazy.
But aren't we losing? Aren't we ultimately, at the end of the day, we're losing that argument?
And we're losing argument for that we're having this argument about collective bargaining.
Right.
That's a sign that we're losing the argument.
But aren't all of these arguments that we're losing a function of the biggest one that you mentioned in terms of the income disparity that we're having? I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, aren't we losing these arguments because there is so much more money to fund the argument on the other side? Whether they do it through the Heritage Foundation, whether they do it through Cato Institute, whether they do it through
AFP. True in 2006 and in 2008.
And difference...
So we can win the argument. There are times we win the argument.
2006, 2008, what I'm asking is that when we have a situation where we have the administration now talking, and I think I heard Harry Reid yesterday talking about $2.5 trillion worth of cuts, $3 trillion worth of cuts, when we have a situation where taxes still on the rich, not at the lowest levels they've been in 50 or 60 years. Isn't that the fundamental argument that we're losing, and don't we need our leadership in Washington to be making that argument with us?
Yeah, and it needs to be coming out of the White House. Listen, that's your bully pulpit. That's your bully pulpit. When you have the White House, that's the one who leads the argument. And I think that the president sometimes is torn between using that pulpit in the right way, and sometimes, and then also perceiving that independents want us to all get along and work together. And I think that temperamentally, he seems to, he has a large part of himself in that camp, which is he sees himself as someone who can get people to work together. And I think that to some degree, the White House steps on itself. And that's, I think, partly why we're not winning the argument sufficiently. But I said in the speech, I think that we've been handed the argument, and it is essentially what the Republicans did in the House, which was to get rid of Medicare as we know it. You know, I spoke at a Jefferson Jackson Day dinner in Michigan the day after that vote, and I remember saying in the speech and getting kind of a big laugh on this, I said, you know, right after the 2010 election, a lot of people wondered if Republicans would overinterpret their mandate. And I think they did. And, you know, this is something we can win on, because Newt Gingrich said it right. This is radical, so radical that people, you know, and he's been trying to back off of that for a long time, but he was right.
Right.
And this is basically saying that when this kicks in, when the Ryan plan kicks in, you're going to have to double, seniors will have to double the amount of out-of-pocket costs to about $12,500 per year for their medical costs. There was never any private health insurance market for people over 65
right
before Medicare was passed, and for a reason. I had a woman at the state fair a couple years ago when all that arguments, you know, the Tea Party people were screaming at people at forums, at town meetings. She came up to me. She's about 75 years old, I'd say, and she said, "You know, when you're at my age, everything's pre-existing." And it's true. When you're right. 75 years old, you got a lot of things wrong with you. And guess what? Insurance companies don't like covering you.
Exactly.
So this is why Medicare was so important, and people know it. And they've been paying into it their whole life, and I'm being told, like, someone pointed to their watch, which
either
me,
someone's selling you a watch or we've run out of time. But
Senator, I thought they wanted me to fix their watch. Huh.
Senator Franken, I am...
See, that's why your staying in this business has kept you sharp.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Knowing that someone pointed at a watch means time. Time's running out.
Yeah, right. Not mean, please fix my time.
Find like, someone on your staff who can take my watch to a place. Sam, it's always been, great talking to you.
It's
great
talking to you.
Marvelously. You look, you
pretty
look
good.
Great. You look
good.
Great.
I look good.
Well,
look
you know,
good.
When you do radio, let's
right.
face it.
You get a little fat.
No, it's not fat.
You, oh, get, a little, maybe, you get a little soft.
No, it's not soft. It's
sitting.
It's dirty.
Yeah. That's right.
It's unkempt.
Yes, exactly.
And you are now here in public, and you look great.
Oh, well, thank you.
Really,
I appreciate
you,
that.
Yeah.
You look very good, too.
You look shaved and washed up.
I did shave.
Your hair looks good.
I washed my hair.
Yeah.
I appreciate your noticing. I did it for you.
You're a good-looking man. You really are.
This is great. I'm going to put that on my website.
Okay.
I appreciate it. It was great to talk to you, and good luck with it.
Good seeing you, Sam.
Good seeing you, too.
Al Franken is the junior senator from Minnesota. Thanks for joining us this week on Ring of Fire. And don't forget to visit our blog at ringoffireradio.com, where you can help support progressive media by subscribing to our weekly podcast. You can also follow Ring of Fire on Facebook. Just click on the Facebook icon on the Ring of Fire blog. Join us, me, Sam Cedar, Mike Papantonio, and Bobby Kennedy, next week on Ring of Fire.
They got this and that with a rattle-a-tap test and one, two. What you gonna do? Bad news, misuse, got too much to lose. Give me some truth now, whose side are we on? Whatever you say, turn on the boob tube. I'm in the mood to obey, so leave.